From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Dan Raviv, national correspondent for Israeli-based I-24 News, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. Our moderator is the White House correspondent for the Weekly Standard, Michael Horn.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. A dramatic day on Capitol Hill Thursday as Christine Blasey Ford, the woman who says Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh sexually assaulted her 36 years ago, delivered emotional testimony detailing her allegations. Kavanaugh was also emotional, denying Ford's accusations. The Senate is set to vote on his confirmation this weekend after President Trump has publicly stood by his nominee. Meanwhile, the future of Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein at the Justice Department remains in question as a planned meeting with President Trump was delayed Thursday. Rosenstein oversees the special counsel investigation that has angered the president for the past 16 months. Plus, President Trump was in New York this week and spoke to the United Nations General Assembly on Tuesday, where he defended his foreign policy and emphasized a principle of national sovereignty. And how did the UN respond? But obviously, we first, gentlemen, have to turn to the big story in Washington this week. What happened on Capitol Hill in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee? A small room. This was a dramatic hours of hearing with both Christine Blasey Ford, the California-based psychologist who says Brett Kavanaugh sexually assaulted her. Brett Kavanaugh was also brought back before the committee, defended himself very vigorously. Dan Raviv, let's start with you. Just your general thoughts on what we saw Thursday and what it tells us about what really happened 36 years ago in Washington, D.C.
Mike, you would have thought that when the Senate Judiciary Committee, made up of 21 senators, starts to ask questions and wants to know what happened in considering whether to approve a federal judge, Brett Kavanaugh, to be elevated to the Supreme Court, that we'd get the truth and that the American people who really tuned in and watched would have a keen sense, a clear sense of what really happened 36 years ago. Did young Brett Kavanaugh, at age 17, attack this woman, whose name is now Christine Blasey Ford? She's a doctor, a psychologist, and a professor on the West Coast. And still, America's confused. People are divided. It's been a question mark as to how all the senators will vote, though most of them will stick with their political parties. And that means the Republicans, who are in the majority in Congress, will support President Trump's nominee. The Democrats seem to be just about all against Brett Kavanaugh. But still, the ones in the middle could make a difference. What did they hear? What did they think? It was remarkable hearing about a sexual assault, as she described it. And she's 100% certain it was Brett Kavanaugh. And he said he's 100% certain there's no way it was him. He never did that to anybody. That was just amazing.
Well, it was striking that what we had learned in the media reports, in the prepared testimony from both of these witnesses about what happened, about their about Brett Kavanaugh's denials, about Christine Blasey Ford's allegations. We didn't learn many more facts in the public hearing that was on television, Dan, as you pointed out. I think a lot of people, a lot of Americans were watching. But, Tom, we didn't learn much. It was a lot about theatrics. It was a lot about emotion. And both witnesses were very emotional and very compelling. So where does that leave us in terms of where people will make those decisions?
I think it leaves the country, as Dan Baltz of The Washington Post wrote, this will leave the country more deeply divided than before. It was a pitiful spectacle. I mean, you just had to cringe. Whatever your politics, whether you believe one or both or neither is lying, whatever one's personal feeling, it was just kind of tawdry. I mean, you had an appeals court justice honored for his judicial restraint and judicial temperament, just kind of losing it. He was kind of out of control, calling himself the victim of a calculated and orchestrated political hit, which he blamed on revenge on behalf of the Clintons. These are not the sort of things you would have expected Lindsey Graham, Senator Graham, or others who are real supporters of the president and supporters of Judge Kavanaugh.
Of course, later Senator Graham did do that too.
Right, that's right. But you'd expect that kind of language, but not from a nominee. And so it was just, I came away feeling pretty slimy. I went back, I should say, and I'll make this a very quick story. My first big story in Washington 50 years ago this summer, was a Supreme Court hearing for Associate Justice Abe Fortas, a crony of President LBJ, and Johnson was trying to get him elevated to be Chief Justice. It went down in flames. I kept all my files, and yesterday I went through them. I read, and I was looking for the tone, and it was a very pitched battle. Fortas had to withdraw. The Republicans, led by Senator Strom Thurmond of South Carolina, a fellow Carolinian, was very tough, but the incandescent quality of that series of hearings was nothing like we saw this week. I mean, it was tough. It was pointed. There were strong points of view, but it wasn't a hearing that made you want to go home and kind of change clothes, at least.
For a second, can we consider what has changed then? Not just since then, but then in 1991, when there was a nominee to the Supreme Court, Clarence Thomas, and a woman who had worked with him in a federal office, Anita Hill, made highly publicized accusations that she was sexually harassed by Thomas. He denied it, of course. So they had hearings in the Senate Judiciary Committee. It was very similar to what happened just this past week. Very similar hearings. The outcome then was whether the senators believed her or not, they still put Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court. He was confirmed.
And if you look at the opinion polls, actually, after the Clarence Thomas hearings, Clarence Thomas's approval went up. After his defense, which was similarly to Kavanaugh's, very emotional.
He was outraged. He said it's a disgrace, in his case, an African-American. So he said this is a high-tech lynching.
Right.
And that was similar to Kavanaugh getting angry on Thursday.
But do we think there's going to be a similar surge of support, a much more divided Washington, where people are sort of in their camp, Dan,
they
believe?
All it takes is two Republican senators to defect, to vote no, assuming all Democrats vote no. So that's why politically in counting heads, yes, it could happen. But also, what else changed? Right now, we're in the age of dozens and dozens of TV channels, right? Real-life reality TV. A president, Donald Trump, who faced, frankly, some allegations also of unwanted sexual advances when he was a candidate, and he rejected it all. And we're just in a different era. And then you add the Me Too movement, where women are empowered to tell their stories, to make their accusations. Corporate America is listening, and many corporate chiefs, people in the entertainment world and business, have lost their jobs. Men have lost their jobs over this. I think we're in a different era.
But let's return first to the hearing, particularly the hearing on Thursday. Tom, you mentioned, and I think that watching the hearing, it was clear when the senators were asking questions, you could see the sort of national consensus on how Americans view the Senate going down with every question from a U.S. senator. But there was something the Republicans did interestingly and differently at the beginning of this hearing. They deferred their questions on the Judiciary Committee to an outside prosecutor that they hired to ask Ford and later Kavanaugh some less politicized and sort of more, seeking the facts type questions. Your reaction to Mitchell, who was that lawyer from Arizona who was asking those questions?
A sex crimes specialist, prosecutor specialist from Maricopa County, Arizona, which is Phoenix. And I think the Republicans didn't want to look like 11 old white guys beating up on a vulnerable woman, alleging horrible things. And so to that extent, it was smart. It was probably also smart that there's not going to be a lot of sound. There won't be any sound bites of 11 white Republican guys browbeating Dr. Ford.
Right.
So to that extent, it was probably useful. I don't think Ms. Mitchell, I don't think she elicited much. I don't think we know more about what did or didn't happen as a result of her questioning than we did before, but it was a little safer politically.
Yeah, Tom, but more than anything, it wasn't about finding new facts. It was about Republicans dodging a bullet. There was a chance that all 11 Republican senators being men, they would have looked terrible grilling the female witness, the accuser. So they dodged that bullet. They didn't want more information. They wanted to put it on the record that we listened to her. We gave her a hearing. That's all they wanted.
And we were respectful to her.
And I think
the chairman, Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, in a very difficult situation, did come across as solicitous of her.
Yeah, polite,
respectful
gracious.
Of her. You know, so nobody could challenge his demeanor.
And so were you surprised in the later session when Judge Kavanaugh came that at first the Republicans also were going to allow that prosecutor from Arizona, that woman, to ask the questions, and then they basically said, oh, forget about it. We have some big things to say to help Kavanaugh defend himself.
Well, I want to talk about one of those things that one of those Republican senators said, Lindsey Graham, who argued very forcefully, somebody who's aligned himself very much with the president in recent months, made an argument that because of the nature of the allegations, because the allegations came out, were known to Senator Feinstein, the ranking member, the Democrat on the committee, for weeks before either Chuck Grassley or anybody else on the committee knew about it, that the entire process would discourage future candidates from seeking something like a Supreme Court seat. Are we in a new era here where we're essentially, if any president wants to nominate somebody successfully to the Supreme Court, they're going to be nominating real choir boys, people who have no possibility of anything like this happening? Where is there going to be a pool of potential nominees?
Well, choir girls would be fine, too.
That's right.
It's ironic, Michael, that was Brett Kavanaugh's reputation.
That's right.
He was a all-American kid growing up in the Maryland suburbs of Washington. He talked the other day about none of his calendars, which he had kept and were entered in evidence, none of his calendar references referred to church, because he said going to church every Sunday was like brushing my teeth. So
right.
I didn't put that down. So his pedigree and his record was one of being a choir boy. And I think he, to a certain extent, he was playing to the Republican base. But I also think, in fairness to him, that he was absolutely outraged. He was enraged what his family has gone through. They have had death threats, according to him. He's got two daughters. I mean, I'm sure this has just been excruciating for his family and for him. And so he had a right to be angry. It's just the whole thing is not edifying, that's for sure.
Well, and no resolution as of yet about what the future of Kavanaugh's nomination. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with more Issues in the News.
You're listening to Issues in the News on the Voice of America from Washington. You can find our program on the VOA website at www.voanews.com. You may also download a free podcast of the program by clicking on the iTunes tab on our webpage. Again, that's voanews.com. Then click on the Listen tab and go to our broadcast programs. You may also visit us on our Facebook page, Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. There you can find links to other programs like Encounter and Press Conference USA. Now, back to our panel. Dan Raviv is the national correspondent for Israeli-based I-24 News, and Tom DeFrank is a contributing editor to the National Journal. Our moderator is Michael Warren, White House correspondent for the Weekly Standard.
Well, we were talking about a potential top judge in the United States government. Let's talk about a current top prosecutor in the United States government, Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, who since the recusal of Attorney General Jeff Sessions on all matters regarding a Russia investigation, has been in charge of the Russia investigations. These have been a thorn in President Trump's side. And there was a question this week, Tom, about whether or not Rod Rosenstein would still be Deputy Attorney General at the end of the week. He was supposed to meet with President Trump at the White House. That meeting didn't happen. It's been postponed to next week. How is Rod Rosenstein's position in this administration?
Tenuous. Very tenuous. I mean, I keep thinking of a phrase I first heard in the Jimmy Carter administration, dead man walking. I mean, I think that Attorney General Sessions will be gone and Rod Rosenstein, his deputy, will be gone at some point after the November 6th elections. The circumstances remain to be seen, but it just seems to me that the president wants them both gone. He has been angry, and he feels like that Sessions, who recused himself from this investigation into Russian behavior. And Rosenstein should have been his strongest allies and feels like that they haven't. And now, so I don't see how they survive that long term.
But this seems to be something that we hear about every few weeks and few months, right? That the president is upset with his attorney general, with his Department of Justice. Nothing ever seems to happen. Dan, there was a story in the New York Times late last week where Rod Rosenstein was described as having talked about potentially having a wire put on the president of the United States, talked about invoking the 25th Amendment to the Constitution, which is a process by which a president can be removed from office by the majority of his cabinet. I talked to the Department of Justice. They said this was a total misunderstanding of essentially a sarcastic comment by Rod Rosenstein. But this seems to have gotten on President Trump's radar and renewed all of this that we've been dealing with for the past 16 months.
Well, it's been more than a week since that New York Times story, and that was a bombshell. In that it seemed very disloyal that Rosenstein in the spring of last year would have said that. Now, it would have been just after President Trump fired the FBI Director James Comey. Apparently, some people in the Department of Justice were shocked. They felt that maybe the president is trying to cover up something having to do with Russia and the Trump presidential campaign. And so the Times learned that Rosenstein raised that possibility. Maybe I or somebody should wear a wire, secretly record the president, perhaps to gather evidence for trying to remove him from office. Now, Rosenstein, obviously in phone conversations with the president, has explained his side. It sounds like he was apologizing, but in saying it was just a sarcastic remark, I don't want to remove you. Rosenstein even put out a public statement saying that he never has done anything that has to do with trying to remove the president, and looking at his recent experiences with President Trump, there's no reason to use the 25th Amendment. That's probably enough, because at the United Nations in New York this past week, President Trump mentioned it, and he said, well, I'm not in a rush to see Rosenstein. I'd rather watch that hearing that involves Judge Kavanaugh. Rosenstein has explained to me. And so it seems that a lot of Republicans have probably suggested to the president, don't start another firestorm. You'd have to confirm a new deputy attorney general in the Senate. If you get rid of Jeff Sessions, you'd have to confirm a new attorney general. At least before the November 6th elections, don't do it. And I think the president's listening to that.
Well, and it seems to me that changes beyond just the Department of Justice that the president wants, or that people in his cabinet or administration want, they're all sort of waiting for that big threshold, the midterm elections, before they move. But, Tom, let's talk quickly here about this thing that's under Rosenstein's purview, which is the special counsel investigation. The question has always been that Donald Trump does not like the special counsel investigation. He would like it to be over. The future, if he does, in fact, fire, or if Rod Rosenstein resigns, of that special counsel investigation. When there was a discussion this week about was Rosenstein about to be fired, people were already lining up to say the special counsel will be protected by another cabinet or another Justice Department official who would then oversee it, who the president could not get rid of. Are we potentially seeing the end of the special counsel no matter what happens between now and November 6th?
Theoretically, but I don't think so. I think even Lindsey Graham, as you noted, Senator Graham, who has become a visceral supporter of the president, he is on record as saying if Mueller is fired, or if the whole Mueller operation is disbanded, that would be a political firestorm like nothing we've seen so far. There have been a lot of bombshells in the last 18 months, but according to Graham, at that point, he said this would be the worst. So I think the investigation would continue. But I think firing Bob Mueller, a wounded Marine veteran,
former FBI director,
would be in highly regarded, and a Republican, it should be noted. I think that would be one of those seismic moments. And the president doesn't need to do that. I'm sure he's itching to do things like that. But I think the people around him have persuaded him, as Dan has already said, timing is everything, and this is a bad time to do that. And I don't think anybody thinks it's good for President Trump to fire Bob Mueller.
Well, we know from experience of the last year and a half that even when the president is getting smart, astute political advice, he sometimes goes off the reservation and decides to act with his gut anyway. So we'll be watching that, of course. Dan, you mentioned the president in New York at the United Nations speaking to the General Assembly. Walk us through that speech that the president gave, which was maybe a little more measured in tone from his previous speech at the United Nations, but no less different in the content and the message that he was sending to the rest of the world.
Well, it still was Trumpian. You know, he has his say. He obviously worked with speechwriters. He totally stuck to the script, except for one thing, and I'm sure everyone around the world saw it, so we should mention it. Near the beginning of his speech, he boasted that his administration has accomplished more than any other administration in U.S. history. And the audience laughed. The diplomats and leaders laughed and chuckled at that. And he was taken aback and said, oh, I didn't expect that, but that's okay. It might not have been, but he claimed later that it was meant to elicit a laugh, so it was fine. Okay, but then he's totally stuck to his script, and here was the main point. He doesn't believe in globalism. He said so. He believes in patriotism, not just putting America first, but he was advocating that all these foreign leaders should put their own countries first. He claims that'll be a better world if every country would protect itself better, pay for its own defense, limit immigration. And meanwhile, in the United States, he intends to do so. He mentioned that foreign aid will only go to countries that respect us and, frankly, are America's friends. These are really big changes. We saw them coming. And Donald Trump intends to make them lasting changes. One thing that went through my mind is, what happens if there's a more conventional president next time, whether it's in about 2 years or about 6 years? Can all of this be reversed, or is Trump really changing America's face on the world? And I would tell you, it's hard to change back. And so I think this president's making really a big change, not such a kind and generous, and certainly also not the leader of the free world anymore.
But it was striking, Tom, to see the members of Trump's administration flanking him in New York. There was Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, very close to President Trump, but not somebody you think of as ascribing to the sort of hyper-nationalistic sort of focus on sovereignty, very much a globalist in the sort of small G form. You have the U.N. ambassador, Nikki Haley, even Vice President Mike Pence, much more traditional types of Republicans on foreign policy. The rhetoric may be Trumpian, but what about the record of the Trump administration that seems to be, at the very least, mixed in terms of pulling back from the world? There's a lot of places that the United States is still engaging in where even President Trump would like not to be. What is the practical effect of this?
Well, I don't think much changes at the moment other than situations where I think the U.S. under President Trump is going to still be sparring with NATO over their contributions to the common defense. I think the president, as you said, Michael, President Trump would prefer not to be in Afghanistan, not to be in Syria, not to be in several other places, but we will be there for the foreseeable future. But he would like over time to dial a lot of that, one of his people once called it adventurism to me, dial some of that back. I tend to think that some of this will change once President Trump is no longer president, whenever that might be, because this is so uniquely personal to his style of make America great again and American exceptionalism. I have to say, I read the speech without listening to the speech, and just setting aside everything else that was going on, I thought it was not a bad speech. I mean, he did, in fact, as Dan says, stick to the script, and you might like it, you might not like it, but it was a pretty creditable performance.
And sort of making an argument, right, about as you've said, Dan, national sovereignty and the fact that he sort of believes that other countries ought to be seeking out sort of their own best interest. I'm struck by the idea, though, of that that seems to assume that not all other countries are seeking out their own best interest at any given moment. It seems to be an assumption that isn't backed up by logic.
Well, Trump's claim would be that they group together too much, that they join multinational treaties. He doesn't like them. He walked away from the Paris Climate Change Accord. He walked away from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He is now destroying NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. And he just doesn't believe in those multilateral agreements, saying that the United States is going to do better in one-on-one negotiations where he believes believes that the big heft of the U.S. economy will give us the power to win that deal, a better deal. And other countries, good luck to you. You know, do what you want to do, but look out for your own interest.
And we won't meddle when you do that, but right. Don't meddle with us.
Right.
Don't tell us what our own interests are.
But that means he's also not planning to recommend democracy and freedom. That's part of not meddling. That's a big change from a lot of presidents in recent decades.
Really, yeah, decades, I would say, of sort of American foreign policy. Well, that's all the time that we have today to talk about the issues. Thanks to Dan Raviv, national correspondent for Israeli-based channel I-24 News, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. This program is produced by VOA's Current Affairs. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites. And I'm Michael Warren, White House correspondent for the Weekly Standard. Thanks for listening.